Yeah, so like I said before we start, is there any particular aspects of what the guys would also like to bring up tonight, so we just keep that in mind as we go through the talk, that we don't go in a direction that is maybe not of interest to anybody. Are you guys still there? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So, well, what I thought about discussing about forgiveness is bringing in Stanley Block's work around the I system and his work around mind-body bridging. Are any of you familiar with that?
No.
No.
Yeah. I'm not going to go through all his stuff because we don't have enough time to cover it in one session. But I just want to bring up the aspects that are relevant to the idea of forgiveness. In a sort of indirect way, but sort of looks at the root of, you know, why we even get to a point where we need to forgive in the first place. And I think before I start, I also want to acknowledge some of the stuff that Sally brought up in the email, because I sort of agree. I can't remember all the points that was brought up, but I think in many ways the word forgiveness is thrown around quite loosely in many ways, and especially sort of new age influence that it always seems like a good thing, and that, you know, these different forgiveness techniques work on any situation. And I think there's a couple of situations where I think, you know, the typical shadow process or the 3-2-1 or talking to your forgiveness or Buddhist Tonglen or whatever, I think can actually be counterproductive and also be damaging, especially in the case of severe abuse, especially if one was a child or anything like that. So I don't think any abuse, especially sexual abuse or violent abuse, one should use a technique where one visualizes or communicates with the abuser in any imaginative way whatsoever. I think that will just re-traumatize a person, and I don't think the person, in my humble opinion, should be forgiven, actually. So forgiveness becomes more relevant when it comes to abuse, because I don't understand why somebody like that has to be forgiven, which might seem quite unspiritual and, you know, contrary to a lot of people's opinion on that, but that's how I feel. And I think And I think in cases like that, the concept of forgiveness becomes irrelevant, but what becomes relevant is the notion of resentment, having a resentment towards a certain person. And then the idea is not to let go of the resentment because you can see the other person's point of view or develop some form of compassion, but rather letting go of the resentment because it doesn't serve oneself psychologically, because it takes up a lot of energy and a lot of space, and one is continuously being traumatized by events that and finding ways how to minimize the continuation of a trauma. So I just wanted to put that in there as well, as that when we speak about forgiveness and all these type of things, resentments, etc., it also has to be within a framework or context of tolerance, that I don't think all these things are applicable all the time with any situation. Any comments on that before I go to the I system? Anybody want to respond to any of that?
It's Rona. I think I just want to support you know, what was said about when a client has been abused or an individual. What I sometimes also find with abuse, especially sexual abuse clients, is forgiveness may mean that it justifies what happened to them.
Yeah.
And that's that part that we said in that email, that it's a complex process, and that will take a long time. They often have to find a way to understand that they never have to justify what happened to them. And sometimes they find that whole mix of processes quite challenging.
Yeah, sure. I think that's a very valid point there, Rona. Lisa, I know that you had some feelings around that last time. Do you want to say anything about that?
Well, I'm not coming from the position of a clinician, so I would agree with everything that's said because I have complete respect for the training that everybody has as clinicians, and I don't intend nor will I ever work with anybody who's been traumatized at that level. So, you know, I completely get where everybody's coming from. I know for working with things myself, having done some of the psychological work on what would be called a trauma, and dealing with the resentments around it, I was not re-traumatized when I experienced forgiveness, and actually when I moved past that into a space of no blame. But I had done my work with a professional prior to that happening, and it wasn't something I did. It was a side effect of that work. One day I realized I didn't blame this person anymore. So I hadn't layered something on top of a trauma and sublimated it. It was simply a byproduct of some rather deep inquiry into the event itself after I had done, you know, plenty of work on the psychological level. So I can, that's only like what I've shared with me in my situation with sexual, what people would call sexual abuse, was not in the least bit re-traumatizing, and I really want to emphasize that it wasn't something I did because I should. It was a happening, and that's really the only way I can describe it. But that's just, and again, I just want to emphasize I'm not a clinician, and I would never impose anything in that vein as a belief system to somebody else that they should do or should not do.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks for that, Lisa. That's really useful.
Yeah, I know my limits.
Well, in a way, I wish most clinicians knew their limits as well, because I think a lot of times us clinicians go into areas where we also don't quite know, really what we're doing in many ways, and should also have healthy limits in that way. So thanks for that.
Sure.
So what I wanted to bring into the mix of this, of the whole discussion is, like I said, some of Stanley Block's work. And why I feel it's very useful to the topic of forgiveness is obviously if one is dealing with a concept of forgiveness, there has to be something to forgive, obviously. And the question is how do these things originate, that we get to a point where the energy is strong enough in a form of a resentment or anger that one feels one actually has to get to the point of forgiveness. So what I want to look at is some of the process from Block's view of what causes resentments, and also in the context of recovery in especially 12-step culture, there's a sort of slogan or saying that resentments is the number one killer, meaning that they believe in the folk wisdom of A would say is that one of the biggest things that lead people to relapse is continuous resentment or just a significant amount of resentment, and then the desire to drink on that or use on that becomes that much greater. And that's also why 12 steps place a significant emphasis on working through resentments via step 4, step 10, and some of the other steps touch upon that. So I want to look at the idea of resentments. So what Stanley Block has done, and I'm just going to go through it very briefly, his whole thing, is that he's developed this sort of theory of what he calls the I system. And pretty much what the I system is what he calls our identity system, which is part of our psyche or a significant part of our psyche that develops to give us a separate sense of self, whether one wants to include the idea of an ego or self into that. You know, that's all sort of it's academic, but he uses the word I system, which refers to our main sort of operating system in our psyche. And according to him, the I system isn't a bad thing, but the I system can also become overactive, in the same way that where our ego becomes sort of overactive in the sense that the different voices that we have as part of our personality starts dominating our thinking, and we start associating exclusively with these different voices, and are driven by them without awareness, sort of against our will in some ways, which is what happens when one is sort of taken over by some voice or state. And what Block is saying is that in most people, certainly in contemporary culture, our eye systems are overactive. And when the eye system is overactive, there's a couple of things that happens within the psyche. The one thing is that the eye system is fueled, basically kept in place by what he calls requirements, which is the different belief systems that we develop, you know, from birth, really, about how the world should be, how we should be, how other people should be, and how other people should treat us, and how we should treat other people, etc. And obviously that's not a bad thing, because we all need that. But these belief systems become, you know, deep-rooted as part of our way of viewing the world, and eventually becomes what he calls requirements. And what happens is, if a person encounters a situation in the world where a requirement is sort of contradicted, let's say a simple one is you're driving in traffic and somebody is driving really slowly, and then, you know, somewhere you have a requirement that everyone should drive at a certain speed, and then the person, screw him, he's not driving in the right way. And that means a requirement has been contradicted. Something has happened in the world that goes contrary to our requirements. And obviously, when it comes to people and relationships and family, these requirements obviously carry a lot of energy. You know, if you're in a romantic relationship, one might have a requirement that my partner needs to be nice to me at all times or most of the time. And when they're not, then a requirement is you know, broken in a way, and then it releases a lot of energy. And what Block says is that these requirements in the eye system are kept in place by two cluster of voices, what he calls the fixer and the depressor. And for those of you, I know some of you are familiar with the voice dialogue work of Alan Sidra Stone, and those voices correlate quite a lot with some of their voices, particularly the pusher, etc. And what happens in the eye system is that one encounters a phenomenon in the world, let's say something like there's a thought that arises that I need to lose weight, for instance, or I need to get fit, whatever. And then what would happen is when that thought, what Block calls, goes into eye system loop, the thought gets sort of kidnapped in a way by these two voices, the fixer and the depressor. In the case of, let's say, I need to lose weight, which could just be a very healthy, normal thought. There's nothing wrong with that. The depressor will come in and say something like, yeah, you know, you should have never picked up so much weight. It's because you're bad. It's because, you know, you're lazy, etc., which is normally a sort of a self-negating voice. And then what would happen is the fixer voice will kick in and say, well, in that case, I'm going to go to the gym 5 times a week. I'm going to practice 5 hours a day, and I'm going to sort out the problem, which is the way. And what's useful about this system is really the idea of the fixer is that in normal circumstances, and one would think the idea, well, I've decided to go to the gym because I want to lose weight as a healthy activity, and most people would agree with that. But what Block is pointing out is that going to the gym is a neutral activity, which can either operate from what he calls unnatural functioning, or it can operate from being driven by the eye system. And if it's an action, it's very often driven by a fixer, which works together with the depressor cell tone. So if going to the gym is driven by the eye system, a sort of phenomenological process will happen, something like this, where you go to the gym, you go 5 times a week, the depressor will kick in and say, well, you're not losing weight and enough weight. You're not practicing as hard as you should. You should do more. Your fixer will come in and say, okay, I'm going to go 6 times a week, or I'm going to extend my time. you do that, the depressor will kick in again and say, well, see, you're going to gym 6 times a week, but you still don't look as good as that person, you know, across from you, etc. And that will just go on and on and on. And one, you know, one can see that type of thing. You know, bodybuilders to me is always a good example. Obviously, if somebody that wants to, you know, be a bit stronger. And, you know, when are these guys like big enough, you know, how big can you get before it's okay, you know, I'm sure a lot of them feel that they're still not big enough, although they're 10 times the size as most normal people. So something like that is just an example of somebody driven by our system with this fixed impressor that's endlessly going around in a circle. So the whole idea is that it doesn't matter what you do, driven by an eye system, you'll get caught up with these two voices and nothing will ever be good enough. And because of that, these sort of cycles reinforces these requirements, because the only thing that can activate an eye system is a requirement. For instance, in the case of the weight, I shouldn't have been overweight, or I should be like this, I should be like that. So anything with a should is normally an indication of requirement. So basically, I'm not going to go into all these techniques and stuff, but basically what he points out is that these requirements, the more of these requirements one has, and the more deep-rooted these requirements are, the more one is prone to having this eye system activated, because that is the root of the eye system, basically these requirements. And every time, obviously the more requirements one has, the more capacity you have to be disappointed. And every time a requirement isn't met, then that will lead to either a sort of short-term experience of anger or disappointment or whatever, or it will lead to a resentment in time. And obviously, as we pointed out earlier, the whole idea of forgiveness is most likely based on the concept that there's somewhere along the line there's a resentment towards something that you need to forgive. And in the context of recovery, one sees the idea of acceptance as one of the spiritual principles of the program. And also the idea of working against, they call it expectations, of sort of working through one's expectations. And doing something like a step four and those type of practices is really, in many ways, not so much about forgiveness. In fact, I don't think even they use the word forgiveness in it, but rather a systematic attempt at sort of detangling and deconstructing our expectations in the context of recovery and in the context of blocked work, our requirements. So the less of these requirements one has, the less it's going to lead to resentment, and obviously the need to forgive becomes less, because there isn't much to forgive. And you know, I find Bloch's idea of the fixer just such a powerful concept, because most psychotherapies, or especially coaching, etc., focuses so much on doing, you know, you've got this problem, you've got this issue, whatever, let's find all these different ways to do things. And obviously there's nothing wrong with doing, but as Bloch points out, a doing is a neutral activity. It's, you are just doing, whether that's good or bad is something that we bring to that. What's in a way more important is what is fueling the doing, you know. So going to the gym, isn't a bad thing, or necessarily even such a good thing, but if it's fueled by the eye system, going to the gym is going to lead to more sort of depressive fixer cycles and more requirements that are either built up, because now you have a requirement as why you need to go to the gym and how you should be in the gym, and ultimately lead to more disappointment and more frustration. Where going to the gym from a natural functioning point of view is you go to the gym and you do whatever you do there, and what happens isn't really that important. So, you know, my interest in the idea of forgiveness is really trying to deconstruct, even not just stopping at the notion of forgiveness, but trying to deconstruct what created the resentment in the first place. And I think what Block points out as well is if one starts deconstructing what he calls sort of shining the light of awareness on these requirements, the requirement in itself can disappear, and then in a way the need to forgive will also disappear, because you can't forgive something that doesn't exist. And I think that's what happens in many ways in step four. That's why, you know, step forgiveness isn't mentioned there. What one is doing there is you're looking at what was the really initial cause, what was the thing that brought in this resentment into life. And 99% of the time, the reason why this resentment existed is that somewhere along the line, one had some requirement of how something should be done, and somebody or yourself or just, you know, life went against that, and that brought about a resentment. And I think that's why for people, I'm still here. Can you hear me?
Guy, we lost your last few sentences or so.
Okay. Am I back now?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So just in closing and in short, so that's why I think the central concept of of the idea of acceptance and is such an important idea for people in recovery is not because it just cleans the house going through their list of resentments, etc., but it develops a new capacity to relate to the world that not prevents one, because we're human, you're always going to have resentments, that's just human to some extent, but it prevents us from continuously building up excessive resentments about things, because very simply what's happened is that our expectations of the world has changed, and our expectations of ourselves has changed, and our expectations have become more realistic. And when I say realistic, I think it's become more neutral, in the sense that, you know, I'm just not happy when the sun shines, is that I'm aware that the sun shines sometimes. When it rains or when the sun shines, because I'm aware that this is the way things are. And if that is brought into one's being in the world, then, you know, eventually the idea of forgiveness sort of starts falling away, because there's very little to forgive. And one often sees that in people that have done a step four, is that whatever next stressor they encounter just doesn't become a resentment. Where in the past it would immediately become a resentment and then get caught into this depressive fixer cycle. But now they encounter the same event and it's like, well, this happened. I'm obviously not happy with it. It's not nice. But it doesn't need to transform into a resentment. It obviously also doesn't mean that one can't have likes or dislikes. But there's a difference between, you know, just not liking something and it becoming a full-fledged resentment that takes up, you know, psychic property in one's mind. So let me just leave it for there, because I think that gives just a fair, you know, little taste of Block's view on requirements and its relationship to forgiveness and resentment.
This is Heidi. I just wanted to let you all know I sent out a diagram of Stanley Block's identity loop to everybody just now as Guy was talking.
Okay.
It's sort of interesting to see, so I thought that was fun to have.
Yeah. Is that the new version you sent? Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. And when you guys look at it, when you look at the diagram, eventually you'll see there's sort of two loops, and it will become clear what I'm sort of talking about. Yeah.
Guys, this is Victoria, and maybe this will show up in the diagram, but I wondered if you'd say a bit more about the mind-body bridge or connection.
Yeah. Okay, sure. So what... Basically, you know, we just spoke about the sort of problem or the theory behind it. What Block basically recommends is two main types of things we can do not to rectify the situation, but to prevent the eye system from being overactive in situations. And a lot of these practices are basically mindfulness-based practices where one brings awareness to the activity. So he would recommend stuff, what he calls befriend the eye system. As you become aware of the eye system, you become aware of how the fixer works, you become aware of how the depressor works, you become aware of your storyline. And one of his main practices, especially his newer versions of stuff, is really spending time on deconstructing a requirement. So as soon as one encounters that, oh, I just realized that I have a certain requirement about something, then he suggests one spend some time through various practices to try and deconstruct this requirement until it becomes, in a way, realistic. And in many ways, and he's thinking is that there are very few, if any, real requirements in the world. You know, there's these things don't exist as a fabric of reality. You know, these requirements are stuff that we've created for ourselves. So most requirements, one will have the capacity to deconstruct most of these requirements, whether they initially seem like perfectly natural ways of viewing the world or not. So that's in many ways what he refers to as mind-body bridging, deconstructing requirements and bringing awareness to the different aspects of the eye system. Because once one brings awareness to let's say a fixer voice is active in one, and you bring awareness to the fixer voice starts losing its power because you're sort of naming it. Listen, you're just the fixer saying this. It doesn't necessarily mean it's valid what you're saying. But when it's unconscious and it happens, then one takes, you know, one can take that voice very seriously and act on it.
Thank you. That's helpful. And it occurs to me that many of these requirements go beyond the personal and become cultural requirements that have been imposed upon us.
Absolutely. I would say probably the vast majority of each of our requirements are long before we even have the capacity to make up our own requirements. You know, by the time you're 5 years old, you've internalized, you know, hundreds of requirements, and each culture has a different, you know, storyline. And that's why different people will treat people differently in different cultures, because they have a different requirement of the world and what it means to be human.
So Lisa here, I love this stuff. You know, guys, it's like right up my alley, because I've dealt with those voices my whole life and identification with those voices. And I recently, what occurs to me is that all of these are irrational beliefs that I have that argue with reality. And when you talked about seeing through them, or that there's nothing left, it's like when I see the belief isn't true, then there's nothing left to resent. And that's how I did my fourth step.
Yeah.
And just one I did recently, real quick, I mean, I spent an hour on this one thought, but I'll just real quickly go through what I did with it. And it was, my husband should love me.
Yeah.
Well, there's some deep pain when I believe that,
sure.
And he appears not to. And what I found was, I asked myself if it was true that he should love me, and I found that what's true is I would prefer he did, but it's not true that he should. That's not what's real. What's real is sometimes he does and sometimes he doesn't.
Yeah.
And then I asked myself how I react when I believe that he should, and I treat him terribly. And then I asked myself how I would treat him if I didn't believe that he should. And I sat with that in a meditation, and what I saw was an amazing connection where I was loving him.
Yeah.
And then I turned it around. This is all the work of Byron Katie, but I turned the thought around to, he shouldn't love me, and that's what's true. When he doesn't, he shouldn't. And I should love me, which if I think it's so easy, let me try it
before
I start demanding it of him. And let me tell you, it doesn't take long when I do that to see, one, I'm arguing with reality, and two, there's nothing to resent. Oh, sometimes he loves me, sometimes he doesn't. Sometimes I love him, sometimes I don't. That's what's true. And these shoulds are so pervasive in taking over. And it's exactly what I did with my fourth step is I wrote down my resentments. I isolated the beliefs. I questioned their veracity. I saw the irrationality of them. I turned them around so I could own the projection, and I woke up.
Sure.
And the resentment sometimes went away completely. Sometimes there was more thoughts to question. But it was such an elegant and quick way to see through that, and it's exactly what this guy's talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's virtually a splitting image of what step four speaks about. He just uses different language and jargon to, in many ways, explain that process. So I'm in total agreement with you there, Lisa.
It's a very powerful process for me in my upper left quadrant. And also my lower left quadrant. When I facilitate other people, I go in there myself with the same beliefs and unravel and construct my own stories. So, yeah, it's just that whole process is one of the biggest parts of my integral practice. It just affects. And just real quickly, I did one on I need to go running. And I had that belief. It hit. It felt like pain. And I looked at it, and I put the word prefer in there. I prefer to go running. And I found where that wasn't true yet. So I sat down and wrote down all the reasons why I do prefer to go running. And I was able to shift into what believed it and run from there. Not run from I need to and the violence of that thought, but I went running from what I prefer to do, and it felt like freedom.
Absolutely. And if one, you know, if one brings that way of thinking to a lot of the things that we accept as sort of fact in psychology, and especially, modern psychology from, you know, the time of the human potential movement, you know, if one just looks at something like, you know, idea that, you know, we should be happy, that it's our birthright to be happy, which seems like a fairly nice thing to say to someone or write.
But you're not happy.
Sorry?
Until you're not happy, and then then the fixer goes, what's wrong with you? You should
be happy. And, you know, and that you should evolve, that you're part of evolution, and it's sort of your right, your birthright to evolve, you know, as part of the universal consciousness. And if you really look at that, that puts quite a heavy trip on one. You know, I can't just sort of just live. I need to, like, really work hard so I can be part of the universe's evolution. I mean, that's a responsibility if one sees that as a requirement, or that I need to be happy, or that I need to be successful, that I need to do all these things. So in many ways, it seems like very rational and very motivating concepts, but a lot of these things also carry the requirement. And, you know, if one takes that requirement seriously, especially in these sort of cosmic rules, it can really, you know, it can really make it pretty difficult for one to live up to those things. And what my interest is what are the requirements, the unarticulated requirements that are very often involved in working a recovery process. What is recovery? Obviously, we all developed requirements of what is addiction, what's recovery, how should recovery look like, where should I be at different stages, etc., etc. And I've certainly found that I think the fixer can be pretty useful for people in early recovery because it just drives them, whether it's for a wrong reason or right reason, doesn't matter. It gets them to go to meetings, do stuff, and get better, whether they like it or not. But I think after a while, if one's recovery and one's self-development is still caught in this I system loop and still driven by the fixer, whether you're working towards cosmic evolution or working towards being the cleverest person on the planet, you know, both of these things are driven by requirements. and will lead to the same eventual disappointment. And I've certainly encountered that in recovery, especially with people with long clean time, that they get to a point where they're doing all the right things, they've done all the therapy, but they just get to a point where it's just not working anymore. And I believe from this perspective, the reason it's not working anymore is that it's not working because it was done by the I system, by these requirements. And then you get to a point where you're running as fast as you can on this hamster wheel. And you know you're at full speed and it's still not working. And that is a more desolate place to be at than to be completely screwed and think, well, you know, one day when I work this program and one day when I do all these things, I'll be fine. When you actually get to a point where you're doing all these things to the best of your ability and it's still not working, I think that is a much more depressing state than the other one. And I think especially at that levels of development or that stages of recovery or self-development, that is where these concepts and practices become particularly useful and to some degrees necessary. Otherwise, you know, one is on the same, one is actually then still caught in addiction because addiction is a way that we've developed to escape our own reality and to escape our own human condition, whatever we perceive that to be. So if our addiction is just being transposed onto a program of self-development or recovery, you know, the ultimate result will be very similar, a point of hopelessness, despair, and powerlessness. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
So what do you guys think the solution is to this predicament?
Well, I gave you mine. I do it on a regular basis. I identify and question my beliefs about what the world, what other people, and what I should need to do. And, you know, that's what I do. I do it on a regular basis. As a practice.
Hamlet, any thoughts?
I'm here. No thoughts, Guy. This topic is kind of a strange landscape for me to navigate through, maybe because I missed the original call and I'm still trying to absorb it all. I wish I did have something to contribute, but a little bit of a loss here. So
yeah.
I'm just going to keep listening.
I think we're all at a loss, so you're not the only one.
Okay.
You're in good company, Hamlet.
Well, this is Victoria, and I'm aware as you're speaking, Guy, that and I'm just looking at the diagram that Heidi sent out, and I have become aware in the past couple of weeks that I have this whole story that I have told myself about my life, and that it is about my having a purpose, a specific purpose that I need to accomplish. That's the simplest way of putting it, and that is what has driven me for at least my adult life. And I've recently been able to see that just is a story.
Mm.
And that it has driven me to, you know, always be aware of time, never enough time, always pushing, I've got to do this, I've got to do that. And it was an incredible revelation to just see that as what you're now calling a requirement. So this is a beautiful way for me to contextualize what I just have been able to move through. And I'm not there yet. It's, you know, it's seeing it. And then the challenge, of course, is how do I implement that in my life, and so it's requiring some big changes.
Sure.
Awesome.
That's one many ways, and in recovery, I was actually having to edit that part in my book that I recently been working on. So I've been giving it quite a lot of thought around that whole concept of how one can start distinguishing, these very, in a way, mercurial concepts from each other. And what I've been working with, and I think we've spoken about it briefly in some of the parts of distinguishing being from doing. And in many ways, the recovery program or, these self-development programs, et cetera, is very often about doing. So we're doing all these things, and there's nothing wrong with it, with doing. And also, obviously, our Western civilization is a very, very doing-orientated understanding of what it means to be, so for us to be human is very much about what you do. If you meet somebody, one of the first questions you ask him is like, oh, so what do you do? And in many ways, that sort of requirement of what it means to be human is also adopted in the recovery world. And recovery is very often then really just seen as this list of practices, which in many ways is true because it is a list of practices. But I think an essential part of recovery and, I think the most important part of recovery isn't really what you're doing. It is what I refer to as more one's being, of how one is relating to the practice, or relating to yourself or relating to the world really at any given moment in time. And it's that quality, that in-between space between, me and the world. Obviously, the existentialists would say there isn't, there isn't a distinction between me and the world, but just for the sake of argument, when I'm relating to something, I think what is of more significance than really what I am doing as somebody in recovery and having a practice is my relationship with that practice. And that relationship, I like to call sort of one's being. And I think it's in between that in-between space that the real recovery happens. And the cool thing about that is that is accessible at any given moment in time. So the way that I'm speaking to you now, the way that I'm sitting here, I can immediately change my attitude or my relationship to that. Pretty much, instantly. I don't need to do a lot of things for that. It's accessible in the moment. Where a doing is something that, if I'm jogging, I'm jogging to get fit, and maybe next week or the week after or in a month, whatever, I'll get fit, and that's fine. But any moment when I'm jogging, also my relationship to jogging is, I think, equally important and in some ways more important than actually what I'm doing. Let's use the example of jogging. Authentic recovery practice is placing quite a significant emphasis on this in-between space, our being in the space, what I call being in recovery, compared to doing in recovery. And once one brings awareness to that space and starts challenging these different relationships we have with all these things and in Brock's context, the different requirements we have with each of our practices, the requirements we have with ourselves, with other people, et cetera, that is where, in a way, the real recovery starts happening, which obviously isn't observable necessarily from somebody from the outside of this, what are all the things you're doing. So I think the not that I'm underplaying the doing, that stuff's all important. You need to, do things to get stay healthy and eat and have relationships, et cetera. But if you only focus on the actual practice, it doesn't necessarily mean the practice will be transformative or will necessarily add to the quality of one's life and one's you know, ultimate state of
mind. One way that I distinguish how I experience that is that it's a distinction between the inside and the outside. So if I'm doing a practice from the inside, it's like it's growing organically from the inside of me, whether I'm exercising or meditating or whatever. And that is the being aspect. But if I'm doing it because it's a requirement out there, and I don't know, it's almost a felt sense, it's kind of hard to characterize it, but it is because I'm responding to something out there, which of course is the hallmark of addiction.
Sure, absolutely.
Beautifully said. That is just so beautifully said. Thank you.
That's spot on. And what Blocker and him have also found by actually looking at these two different states, what he calls the executive network and sort of the other natural states, is that these are actually two in some ways two different brain states that one is also in. So when you are in this fixer, like you said, driven sort of from the outside, then your brain actually takes on a certain pattern, a certain energy pattern or state, whatever one wants to call it, and will have a certain effect on one's whole body, you know, through glands and neurotransmission, etc. And when one is in the natural functioning state, which could be referred to when you say doing things from the inside, then one's brain state is actually remarkably different to the other state. And sort of part of mind-body bridging or any of these practices is to become aware of how these two different states feel. And when you're doing something and you can actually feel yourself in this particular state, you can figure out, well, listen, I'm probably being driven by the I system and by requirements right now. I'm not being driven by natural functioning. And then one doesn't necessarily have to change the action. One can just change one's state, or what I was referring to, sort of one's relationship or being with the act to the action, which ultimately will have quite a significantly different effect on one over a long period of time, or even a short period of time for that matter.
Yeah, I've even noticed with my husband, if he does something and the thought hits he doesn't love me, I start to kind of laugh internally. Like, I can shift immediately now because I don't need to go through that process again. Like you said, it's like I don't have to wait and do a process. I can just shift into what knows the truth, which is I don't know what he's feeling, and isn't he adorable doing what he's doing? And that, I love what, I guess it was Victoria said about, I shift from the inside instead of, you know, I see him from the inside instead of from an external story about how he should be. And I love the way you said that. It's such a quick way to just shift perspective.
Sure. Absolutely. You should write that down, Victoria. Send it to us.
Thank you. I'll try.
Well, you shouldn't. If I'm saying should, I'm immediately putting a requirement on you. So if you'd like to, you can.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We still got a couple of minutes left, about 4 minutes or so. anything anybody wants to add in closing?
Sorry, someone else wanted to come in?
No, go ahead.
No, you got this. It's fine. Mine's not really that important.
Guy, I just wanted to, before we close, if you wanted to bring up, I sent you an email you may not have gotten yet about setting up a group. I don't know if you want to talk about this now or float the idea by anybody about setting up a group meeting or not in a time for that.
Yeah. I haven't had a chance to go through all the details of your email yet.
Okay.
But I think it's around the idea of setting up a specific sort of peer run group between all of you guys where you just connect with each other. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what is the next step that maybe you'll just contact everybody and try and set up arrangement between all of you that will work?
Yeah. Well, it's a matter of, we talked about what it is Guy and I had talked about an idea of a support group meeting for IR and start that with just us doing that and having, like, take turns, facilitating it once a month, just we each go around, something very simple, but, a call-in like this that can be accessed either by Skype or by phone, and the company has given us their account to use to do that, so it would just be a matter of being able to get in contact with each other to set up the first one. I don't have access to everybody's emails, and I don't know that everybody has given permission to have that, so I'll leave that to the powers that be and to Heather to Heidi and whomever needs to do that. But if for those who are interested in participating, that's what we were talking about, setting up a weekly meeting that we can participate and just share with each other.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that sounds good. Is everyone fine with that?
I like that.
Yeah.
So if anybody doesn't want their email given to me, please let Heidi know. If they don't want to break that anonymity or they don't want to participate for any reason, it's absolutely fine. But if you do, and if you could give Heidi permission, I'll send you the information about it and how we can throw around ideas of how we want, what we want to do in it.
Hi, Lisa. This is Heidi. I've heard from almost everyone. I was just waiting to hear from everybody before I share all the emails.
Not a problem. Okay. I don't need to take up any more time on the call with this. Somebody else had a question, I think, or a comment.
Okay. sorry, Rhonda, you wanted to say something as well before we went there?
I think it's not really that important. A brief, one might be a very superficial thought. I've been exploring, working a lot or exploring acting a lot. And what I find interesting is the acting is a very useful metaphor almost if you look at the storylines in the eye system loop. I just thought it might be an interesting scene to explore linked to this diagram. If one looks why people enjoy movies, and if you look at the acting profession and also looking at theater, I think a lot of it associates with these storylines, different scripts that are portrayed, and that people are often attracted to scripts that portray the natural loop, perhaps. It's just a thought. I just find it quite a useful scene to work with in the work we're busy with to explore further. That's the one thought. Yeah. Because the storylines and the scripts in plays and also ancient plays and current plays are often very similar to what we're dealing with here. And it's just useful to work with. And then the other thing is the recent conversations I've been involved in, there's a lot of focus on the world being stuck in the divine male energy, and the balance that's needed with the female energy internally, also linking to the earth more, and that would also be interesting to explore with this diagram. I was just having thoughts around that the natural loop could possibly connect that balance between the male and the female energy within the individual.
Yeah, sure. That's an interesting perspective. Maybe we can explore some of that probably on the talk on Friday, if it's possible.
Yes, it's just something I wanted to throw out there.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks for that. Thanks, Rana. Okay. Yeah, we've got to the end. Well, thanks again for everyone's participation. It's always a pleasure with having a chat to you guys. We'll let you know what what we'll do on Friday.
Cool. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Guy. Very interesting. Bye.
Thanks.
Take care, everybody.
Bye, everyone.
Bye, everybody.
Okay. Bye.